I got hit by a van actually in the build up to the race, ended up with a concussion and a broken collarbone. You become delusional. You'll fall asleep on your feet. My knees just locked out and I stood there asleep. Run along Hadrian's Wall, it's 69 miles long. Came fifth and I was just aiming to finish. So I signed up again the next year and set a new course record.
This week's physical specimen, Tom Jolly. Tom, it is an absolute pleasure and a privilege to have you on the pod this week. I can't tell you how excited I've been. Looking forward to getting you on here and hearing about your incredible exploits. An athlete of your caliber is very significant indeed. Currently Ultra X world champion, a number of Ironmans under your belt as well, qualified for Kona, the mecca of triathlon, back in 2019, and eventually did the deed after a couple of years being postponed in 2021. It's great to have you on. How are you doing?
Great. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. It's my first podcast recording, so I'm quite excited. Very good knowledge there. Yeah, qualified in 2019 and then finally got to go last year, which was a real treat.
Yeah, COVID, right? What a nightmare. It really kicked everything down the road a bit. But before we get into your numerous incredible achievements and how you've kind of transitioned into ultramarathons, there's always this question when it comes to athletes, which has always kind of fascinated me. There's no doubt about it that you don't get to where you are today, regardless of what sport you're in, what discipline, without putting in the hard work. You can be genetically gifted, but you got to get up in the morning. You got to get out there. Bearing that in mind, this nature-nurture question, I find really interesting. And so to what extent did things come quite easily for you and you realized, actually, I quite enjoy this. I'm well adapted. This is my bag. And to what extent, certainly kind of as you were growing up, perhaps your childhood or later kind of formative years, what extent did nurture play and your kind of context at that time, which has brought you to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I studied zoology, so nature nurture is always sort of in the back of my mind when it comes to sport and training. I suppose I grew up in a sort of countryside setting in Suffolk and Norfolk, so we were always very active outside, you know, doing things that out in nature, is always out and about playing in the woods or, you know, doing that sort of thing. And then at school, played lots of different sport. I was never the best. I was never in any of the top teams at school. I think my best performance in cross country at school was like 10th. But I was always, you know, keen to participate, play in as many sports as I could, just loved playing sport, even if I was never the best. But I was sort of that sort of dogged, determined person on the pitch who just keeps running up and down and doesn't sort of give up. So I think that sort of has led me to ultra distance events, particularly obviously ultra running, and that sort of background. In terms of, is it nature or nurture? I think exactly as you say, it helps if you were born at 2000 meters and you've been training every day from a young age, particularly I think before, you hit puberty, if you've already developed a sort of system and a large sort of aerobic capacity before you then go through the adult growth phase. I think that's a huge impact. And you can see that now in a lot of the like top cyclists and top runners who've, you know, you hear about East African runners who've been running to school every day since they were five and whatever else. So I think there is a balance. It helps if you have the talent, but like you say, you've still got to put in the long hours and the hard work.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's quite a jump from, you know, being really interested in sport and getting involved. Although, as you say, you know, nothing spectacular at school. Growing up in Norfolk, being in touch with the outdoors, there's quite a jump between that and becoming world champ of this Ultra X marathon series. Fill us in a bit on your journey as to how you've got to your current situation.
Yeah, I think that is a fair comment. It's not like it just suddenly one year started running and then suddenly won this big event. So I suppose after school, university, didn't do much apart from play a bit of football, but then really, and got quite unfit, sort of drinking, smoking, and doing everything else you do at university. And sort of that kind of kick-started me into thinking, no, I need to get back into shape. I need to go get a job and, you know, get on with life. So I thought, I know, I like being outdoors. I like sports. My dad was in the army. I'll join the army. I need to get fit. So I was like, I know, I'll sign up for an Ironman. Didn't really know anything about triathlon. Went straight in at the deep end, did Ironman Wales off of like very little training. I'd never swam the distance, I'd never cycled the distance, I'd hardly even cycled before then. So it was quite a sort of diving into the deep end experience. Then did Ironman Nice sort of the next year while I was waiting to get into the army, did a personal training course. If I didn't get in, then at least I'd have a qualification and potentially a job. So it was all sort of building up gradually my own knowledge in triathlon and training and things. And then obviously in the army, you know, I went to the Scots Guards, so as an infantry, as an officer. But as an infantry, you spend a lot of time on your feet, often with big weights on your back. So that really, I think, sort of was the beginning of real training, structured training. And obviously a lot of strength work. And then I did two seasons actually of Nordic skiing, which is quite good. So we were literally, it was eat, sleep, train, repeat, you know, training 4 hours a day, often in Norway or France or Germany, for 2-3 months of the year. And then the rest of the year, you know, I was either training with military stuff on exercise or doing cross country or playing other sports. So I think that was sort of the base building years, that sort of initial really getting into it. And I'd always wanted, I liked the idea once I'd started doing triathlon that I could potentially make it to the top level. So that's why I decided to leave the army after 4 years of service. I thought, you know, I've got a shot. Now's the time to go. Otherwise it's, you know, it's now or never. So I left the army then, and then with a sort of 9-to-5 more regular job, you then have that ability to get into a routine of training where often, you know, in the army, you're not getting the right amount of sleep. You can't get good food. You can't get, you know, the consistency that you really need to develop as an athlete.
You said a lot of things there. We've got a lot of material to get into. And I think kind of coming back to the main objective of why we're here, what we're trying to do with this project, obviously get inspirational people such as yourself who have got, you know, unbelievable credentials when it comes to serious endurance races, and really try and lift the lid on how you achieved what you have. And so link that, we got, right, well, if this guy's done it, it's possible. And then really kind of break it down to produce kind of some actionable info for how people can go about doing that.
For sure.
And provide some resources to take them on their way. So taking it back a few steps, I love that you jumped into Ironman Wales with pretty optimistic about things, never having swum the full distance or the bike. How did you go about kind of informing yourself as to where to start, even where to take things forwards from there?
Pretty limited resources looking back at it now. I had no money, so I think I did the entire thing on £1,000. So for the entry, buying my bike, shoes, helmet, wetsuit, the works, did it for £1,000, which is pretty good going.
Unbelievable, given that the entry fee is what, about £600?
Yeah, I was like £400 back then. I was doing the charity entry, so it was like £100, you know, all these little things that sort of helped to broke students get into it. But I mean, mostly it was just like online forums, And you know, watching YouTube videos, that kind of really basic level. I think this is sort of a question we'll come onto later, but you know, if I'd actually had a bit more money or time to actually invest in talking to the right people, whether it's a coach or a sort of consultant or just someone else who's been in the sport and knows a bit more background, I think would have been massively helpful at the time. Because I was, diving in, didn't really have any idea about the sport. Or, you know, I was training in Norfolk and I was racing in Wales. And of course, Wales course has like 2,500 meters. I think that's more elevation than I probably covered in my total training in Norfolk. So it was a bit, you know, all these little things that are a big shock on the day that you just don't appreciate.
Sure.
And then I think going on from there, really, like I built my own program. It was very, very simple. It was start easy. And each day you just increase the amount of training you do. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked out progressive overload. What I didn't understand is obviously you need to deload those weeks and allow for periodization and all the rest of the other training principles.
Yep.
So I think my training was obviously pretty limited. And that, mm-hmm. again, would be obviously very useful if you've spoken to someone who actually knows how to properly program or even get a program, you know, online or whatever.
For sure, for sure. Moving forwards, so you join the army. That must have been a pretty phenomenal kind of background to you're getting paid to essentially do exercise, as you say, heavy loads on your back the whole time. What kind of positive influence, what kind of tools did that give you on the physical side? I mean, it's pretty clear. But then also kind of from a mental resilience perspective as well, I imagine that must have been pretty useful.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, some of the hardest days I remember were in Brecon during the winter doing, you know, platoon commander's battle course. It's like a 3-month long course. You spend 8 weeks on exercise, getting very little sleep, carrying lots of weight. And certainly the mental aspect was harder, if probably, than the physical aspect. I was about 70 kilos sort of back then, but you're carrying 40 up to 50 kilo on your back, which is a lot when you've got like a slightly smaller frame like me. But certainly, you know, going 4 days, 5 days at a time with like 1 or 2 minutes sleep, that really, really pushes you mentally to the point of almost, you know, I would say almost harmful points, because you become delusional and you'd be walking along and suddenly you'll fall asleep on your feet and either fall in the ditch, or on one occasion I fell asleep, you know, and my knees just locked out and I stood there asleep while we were on patrol, and the guy came up behind me and said, "Boy, if we stopped," and I didn't know what was going on. But so there were plenty of occasions probably where it wasn't a good thing.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And then, so kind of moving things forward from there, you had some excellent training and Nordic skiing as well. Build a phenomenal aerobic engine off that. So I can see where, as you said, that really built a very solid kind of foundation to take things forward and progress from there. And then you mentioned after 4 years, you thought, this is my shot. How did that moment of realization come about? What were you doing in kind of the meantime? Was this something you were actively pursuing, or how did it catch your imagination to go, I've seen this, I think I could give it a crack, and I think I could do pretty well?
That's a really good question again. So one of the other officers in the Scots Guards, I was up at Catterick at the time, and he said, let's do a race. And I went, well, let's do an Ironman, obviously. And he went, no, let's do something else. Let's do an ultra marathon. I was like, an ultra marathon? Like, what's that? And he was like, well, this one, you run along Hadrian's Wall, it's 69 miles long. And I was like, it seems like, you know, what about the bike? It's just running. Sounds a bit boring. Anyway, he persuaded me to sign up, and I did a bit of training, you know, on top of the other stuff I was doing in the military, but not like crazy mileage, maybe 100 kilometers a week, mm-hmm. On a big week, if I included all the military training as well. Rocked up to this race, the Wall by a Rat Race, You start from Carlisle and you run across to Newcastle, and I came fifth, and I was just aiming to finish. And I was like, huh, interesting. Maybe if I put a bit more effort and training into it, I could actually, you know, maybe even win this race. So I signed up again the next year, and ran it again and set a new course record there, and won by, I think, about an hour over second place. I was like, here we go. I think I found my niche. And it kind of, that's the sort of moment where I was like, time to go. This is what I'm going to pursue as a professional, or at least, you know, try and reach the elite level.
What a moment of realization, and to clear everyone by an hour. I mean, one of these races, especially because I think a marathon, pretty accepted concept. Everyone knows what a marathon is. A lot of people, you know, a half marathon is a serious achievement and something that a lot of people kind of aim towards. When it comes to ultra marathons, it becomes quite niche all of a sudden, and there's not a huge kind of amount of definition, essentially anything over a marathon. But this could range from 50K to, you know, what, Sri Lanka was what, a 250K multi-day event?
Yeah.
So they vary quite significantly. This particular one on Hadrian's Wall, what kind of time are we looking about that you're on your feet slogging this thing out?
So I think it was 9 hours 38 for the second time around. It was about 12. I think I was bang on 12 hours the first year.
Okay.
And then 9 hours 38 the second year. So quite a massive improvement, over 111 kilometers, I think, 69 miles.
Okay.
So it was about 5 minutes 13 per kilometer pace for the second time around.
Which is unreal, given the terrain that you're crossing there, you know. A fair clip. So from there you're like, right, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna start taking this seriously and work towards this. But interestingly, you decide to leave the army and go and find a 9-to-5 rather than staying in an environment where you're getting paid to run around, and now you've got to juggle work and training.
I also had this sort of idea that if I was going to leave, I needed to do something that was obviously going to support me financially, but allow me to train. So I had this idea of starting a training camp, and I went on holiday to Sierra Nevada in the south of Spain after reading a book about it, and went to this place, absolutely fell in love with it. And I was like, right, I'm going to move there. I'm going to start a training camp. And that way I can train full time and also bring in some money. I saved up a bit in the army, but I needed more money. So obviously, I started a job in a, concrete block company, for about 3 years, to save up more money. And during that time I bought a house in the south of Spain. And so it's like slowly coming together, still doing lots of training, but not yet training full time. So it was sort of just like, I'm sure when you've been training for Ironman, you know, getting up at 6, going to the pool, go to work, you know, maybe even squeeze in a short run at lunchtime and then come back and then do an hour or two on the turbo or something, trying to fit in training. So it was that kind of thing for about 3 years or so. So I was probably training, I think, about between 600 hours and 750 hours during those 3 years. Okay. So a decent amount, but probably not, you know, still significantly less than, say, an elite athlete.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm trying to work out 600, 700 hours over, what, 3 years. So on a weekly basis, what are we looking
at? Yeah, so on a weekly basis, I was doing 12 hours a week.
Okay.
If you sort of average it out.
Yeah, yeah. So
which is still, you know, it's like 2 hours a day. Sure. with a day off or so.
Yeah.
Or like, it doesn't sound like that much, you know, looking back at it now. I don't know how many hours you're training at the moment. Or
limited, to be honest. certainly nothing in comparison to your Strava, that's for sure. Which we will get on to.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I'll be doing some maths, don't worry.
Nice.
Love a good bit of data. And so you stuck at that for 3 years. By the way, congratulations. I mean, the absolute dream. Right, I'm going to go down to south of Spain and I'm just going to make this happen and try and find a way out. An incredible kind of existence there. And so during those 3 years, you were kind of bouncing across were you at that point in Norfolk and south of Spain?
Yeah, so basically using my leave to go out to Spain, try and set up the house, ready to do camps. And I set up the house, got the website going, you know, getting an Instagram account set up, everything, advertising. Yeah. I was just about to get going in February 2021. Is that right? 2 years ago? 3 years ago? Anyway, start of COVID, whenever that was.
Yeah.
So that actually basically it fell flat on its face. And I was like, great, now I've got a massive empty house in Spain and I've got nothing to do with it. Sure. So with each year, then obviously, because of COVID, I was having to work quite hard at work covering various desks. But then when I got time off, you know, I could, you know, the whole working flexibly thing really kicked off working remotely. So I started spending probably 2-3 months of the year between in Spain and then the rest of the time in Norfolk. And so each sort of year, that's where the training gradually ramped up, you know, an extra 100 hours a year. So I spent more and more time sort of working remotely, shirking from home. As long as I have my phone on me, you know, I could probably get away with being outside on the bike or whatever.
So you had your mouse hooked up to the fan that was moving it from side to side, is what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's incredible how COVID and working from home has changed things. Yeah. Okay, so then you moved out. So this was around about 2018, you moved out there. And then since 2020, you've been there full time. Now permanently based down there.
2022. I moved out here at the start of 2022. So I've just done one full year of training, basically, with about 6 months out here and then a few months around different countries racing and then a few months back in Norfolk.
Okay. And training camp now in full flow. How's the progress been there?
So the number one goal was always going to be my own training. So the training camp was going to be there to facilitate that. Because I spent more time in the UK working, I could save up more money. And so basically I could just then focus entirely on my own training, not have to worry about work, at least for, you know, I built up enough savings on a sort of fag packet calculation that this should keep me going for another 2 years or so.
Yeah.
Before, you know, I have to sell the house or, you know, prodigal son returns and asks for a job or whatever. So that's basically been the plan. So it's 1 year in. And last year, interestingly, I'd say I sort of between my race winnings and other, you know, tiny amounts from sponsors in terms of kit or whatever, mm-hmm. I'd say about managed to balance the books by about 50%. So at the end of last year, I was still, you know, at a 50% loss from what I spent to what I earned. So this, you know, there's only so long I can keep going before, you know, I probably need to get a bit of a side hustle going and start working on the sort of coaching side, camp side of things again.
Sure. Yeah, it's very interesting listening to kind of professional athletes and from the financial side, you know, it is a huge commitment. Even if you're like yourself, you know, smashing these races out of the park, trying to get by, and then especially, you know, talking to triathletes, getting involved in kind of Ironman and things like the costs and the travel costs. Like even if you're winning, by the time you've paid for the plane, your hotel, you've got to be out there a couple of weeks before acclimatization. You know, you've got to be coming top five in these massive races. Otherwise, you're at a loss.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what Joe Skipper said for Kona this year. Maybe that's where you're pulling that number from. He's like, correct. You know, if I don't win 12 grand, I'm going to spend 3 weeks out there. And it's so expensive. Like, it was crazy because we had obviously two days of racing last year. Mm. So everything was booked out weeks in advance and there was no space on the island. Yeah, I mean, that's a sort of once in a lifetime race. this year. I'm trying to, you know, race more locally, stay in Europe, drive if I can, all those kind of things. But yeah, it does add up. It's a lot of travel. It's a lot of expenses.
For sure. And so bringing it back to kind of what you've been achieving over the last couple of years, how you've got to the position you are at the moment, and what races were involved to win this unbelievable title. Could you give us a bit of an idea as to what the kind of profile of those races look like, the distances involved, some of the locations that you've been traveling to?
So last year, the season was sort of split into two halves. There was first half of the season, I was focusing on a race here called Ultra Sierra Nevada, which is 100K. You run up to 3,000 meters, finishing on a red run ski slope covered in snow. It's brutal. But it's great. So that was sort of the initial focus. So I did a lot of running then in the build up. And then the Ultra X World Champs in June was sort of the second main focus for the year. So I'd say probably during that time, generally I was running 100 miles a week, but that would include a few high intensity sessions a week and between 6,000 and 9,000 meters of vertical gain a week as well. So it's not just like 100 mile a week doesn't sound that much, but when you throw in 9,000 meters of vert, it suddenly becomes a whole different ball game.
And just to put that into context, Everest is 8,849 meters.
In height. I feel like it always gets
scale there.
I feel it gets misquoted because if you actually climb Everest, you're probably doing, I don't know, 12,000 meters of vert at least as you go up and down. You've got to walk, to, you know. But yeah, in terms of it is obviously a lot of up and a lot of down. But was really useful. Slovenia, the Ultra X World Champs was in Slovenia, in the, I suppose it's the edge of the Alps, and you know that had 10,000 meters of vert over the 5 days. So it was not, it was nice sort of comparison to prepare for the race there. And then the second half of the year, going to Kona, obviously big. Like the travel was just nuts. It was like three flights, accommodation got cancelled, flights got changed, the works. So it all sort of became quite a big effort just on the travel side of things. And then where did I finish? And then Thailand in December. So again, another quite far flung race with a lot of travel and expenses and things involved for that one. Yeah, so that's sort of the travel side.
All over
where I've written last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just in case for anyone who's listening doesn't quite appreciate the significance of Kona, this isn't just a race that you sign up for and happens to be in Hawaii and is in as a beautiful place. You've got to qualify for this. So you've got to come in any Ironman. You've got to be, what is it? Is it top five or is it top 10?
Depending on how many people are in your age group,
right,
will dictate. So if they have 50 slots at a race and your age group is quite large, let's say in the 30 to 35 category, 34 category, then there's probably quite a lot of athletes in that age bracket, so there might be three or four places. But if you're in the 18 to 25 age group, there's probably only 10-20 people, so there might only be one slot for your age group. So it really depends how old you are and how many slots there are.
Sure. So significant achievement in itself to get through to that and to get to Kona, which is an absolutely brutal race from all accounts. You're essentially, you know, cycling through lava fields, which have just been absorbing all the heat throughout the day, wind against you. How did you get on?
I had a really good race on the day. Pretty much everything went to plan. I got hit by a van actually in the build up to the race, ended up with a concussion and a broken collarbone. So my swim was a bit, you know, behind the curve. I was 108, which I was pretty happy with given those circumstances. And then my bike was 4 hours 55, and I'd been training out here on, you know, 15% gradients on my road bike. Really, I should have been actually probably training back in the UK on the time trial bike. But I was quite happy with the bike split. Got a 5-minute penalty. Similar. I've worked out now why I got a 5-minute penalty. If you saw the 70.3 world champs with Sam Long, I think I had basically a similar situation where you have to overtake the person in front, but you were then dropping into the draft of the person who's already overtaking. But apart from that, bike went well, extremely dehydrated and hot when I got off, and hadn't done a huge amount of running because I'd been focusing on the bike, but still managed to just squeeze out. It was just over 3 hours. I think it was 3:04 in the end. But the it lives up to the reputation. It's boiling hot, black tarmac road. You go into the energy lab, which is like in this little dip. So suddenly the breeze goes, and that headwind that's been keeping you cool then becomes a tailwind on the way back up. So you're running uphill, but you have no cooling effect. And that's actually, you know, just like everyone else, is suddenly where the wheels come off, you get out of there and you're completely toast. And then you've got 10K back to the finish line. So it was perfect. It was pure suffering. Exactly lived up to the reputation. 9 hours 20 in total, which I was really happy with. And about 166th, I think, overall. So it was a good experience.
Very impressive indeed. Sounds absolutely horrific. and so from then, you decided to ditch triathlon, essentially. And that was largely because you enjoyed the running more? Or was it purely you felt you were better at it? How did those things come together?
I'd spent all of 2021 focusing on triathlon because I thought, okay, Kona's already been cancelled in 2020. It'll happen in 2021. Go all in triathlon. I did 2 70.3s where I came 9th and 11th, but there was no pro field. And even if there had been a pro field, I was still just outside of the qualifying time to get a pro card license. Right. So I think I was about 12% off of the course PB, and I needed to be at 7% over that time to get a professional license. Mm-hmm. And then went to Kona, saw what Gustav Iden did with 7 hours 40. It's just off the chain. Yeah. Just ridiculous. Amazing. I was like 17% outside of his time or something, and I had to be 10% if you want to get a pro license. And I was just like, yeah, you know, triathlon's been great, it's got me into the whole endurance sport scene, but it's probably time to put it aside. Ultra running is obviously where the skill set is sort of strongest.
Sure. Just briefly coming back to the facts, which we glossed over quite quickly, that you got hit by a van. How much time before the event was this?
11 weeks. So I was taking some time off between Ultra X World Champs and Kona. And I thought, I know, I'll get bike fit. I'll go bike touring and use it as like a holiday. That's like training and holiday at the same time. And I got four days in. I was just north of Madrid, actually. And he just pulled out, didn't see me, smack into the back. And I think I was going about 30 kilometers an hour, concussion. Bike was, you know, smashed on the road. And I was like, knew straight away. I was like, it's broken collarbone. And so the next few weeks were a bit uncomfortable.
I can imagine, not to mention having to swim just under 4K a few months later. Incredible that you managed to pull that off in itself. And how did you, just outside of Madrid, that's still, you're quite far from home.
Quite a long way.
Taxi. How did you do that?
I was really lucky, actually. some mates from Sandhurst were cycling to Madrid, and I'd literally seen them that morning. So while they were carrying on to Madrid, I stayed in a hotel for 2 nights, and then they picked me up on their way back and took me back to the UK. So a kind of weird, fateful event that worked out okay in the end.
Thank God for that. Yeah, otherwise, not an ideal situation at all. So moving on to, I think whilst we're on that topic of injury, you've had a bit of bad luck along the way as well. You picked up a couple of injuries, had some surgery. I think this is a really kind of important lesson that, that we can learn here, and happens to a lot of people. And so learning how to deal with that, injury prevention, and also especially for someone such as yourself who is living and breathing exercise, to suddenly be stopped in your tracks, it's got to have a mental toll as well, because you're not doing something that you enjoy, you're not getting the endorphins that it gives you, and it's a hard stop. How did you, well, first, what exactly happened in your case, and how did you go about dealing with that?
So a few injuries over the years. Had ankle surgery at the end of 2020 or start of 2021. But like you say, the sort of mental aspects, definitely for that sort of long-term recovery, is definitely tougher. You lose your sort of, as an athlete, your whole sense of purpose, your sense of value and self is I'm an athlete. So when you can't train, you know, your character, your ego, everything is suddenly threatened. So that sort of side of things is definitely harder. But I think the important thing is injury prevention, yes, but actually also accepting, particularly the higher up you go, the more you're pushing your body, the more, you know, you're trying to peak and get that last drop of performance out of you, is, you know, you're going to have lower body fat, your immune system's going to be suppressed, you're going to have, you know, more muscular injuries and whatever else. And so it's developing a mindset, I think, of it, rather than injury prevention, is injury management as well. And you have to accept that it's part of the process, and injuries will happen. So be prepared, you know, how are you going to deal with them when they do arise? But yeah, obviously prevention is better than the cure. So, you know, I do a lot of strength and conditioning now. And I think since that initial ankle surgery injury issue, that really has sort of cemented in my mind how important the whole sort of maintenance and prevention side of things is for performance.
Absolutely. I think that's something we touched on actually on the last episode as well. This idea of strength training being kind of core to supporting your training, and from an injury prevention side of things. But how do you go about structuring that? Kind of moving into training now, how do you go about working out what you're going to do on certain days? Are you still self-coached at the moment?
Yeah, so fully self-coached. The program evolves constantly. So like last year was a great opportunity to try out different, you know, training methods, see what works, see what doesn't, tweak something here, change that session to this day. And now I think I'm at a pretty sort of happy place as to weekly routine, strength and conditioning. Generally, I'll do 3 times a week, approximately an hour session. And I'll do those on the easier run days or easier aerobic days, so that, one, you're not blunting the effect of any hard training from earlier that day, but equally, you know, you don't want to be trying to do suddenly intervals when you've got, you know, loads of squats in the legs or something, because you're just going to impact one session to the next. So it's sort of just balancing out those harder sessions with the easier sessions, and making sure, you know, you're keeping some days, not every day is hard, and making sure some days are easy in between.
Absolutely. So always strength training first, and then if you're complementing it with more training on the day, do your training afterwards.
I'd always do my strength training in the afternoon session. So after whatever I've done in the morning, generally, because I think, you know, the run session, the bike session, whatever it is the priority. So you want to maximize the potential there, and the strength and conditioning sessions, they're there to assist. Mm-hmm. They're there to help, you know, prevent injuries. And it's not sexy stuff. You know, I'll do some squats and things, but there's no, you know, there's no bicep curls in the mirror. It's all it's all calf raises. I'm using one of those wobble boards for ankle stability and strength. I'm doing, you know, really weird exercises, you know, working on your hips, clams. It's I would never record it or take any photos for social media, because it looks so, you know, so basic and boring and uninspiring.
This isn't the beach muscle routine then, is that what you're saying?
No, unfortunately, unfortunately not.
But I think this is interesting, and I think we can get into this further. So you're saying three sessions a week. So what exactly are you looking at? So Monday, for example, or Tuesday, or whenever the last time you did your session, how did you break that down? What kind of muscle groups were you focusing on, and what sort of exercises were you doing?
So it'll be a 10-minute warm-up. Generally, I do skipping. Really good way, just again focusing on the calf and ankle muscles, and also getting warm at the same time. And then it'll be a sort of second warm-up set, doing squats with a kettlebell, so not a heavy weight. Mm-hmm. And then again, either kettlebell swings or sort of deadlifts, again just with kettlebell light weights, just to warm up the body. And then I'll go into main sets of, say, squats with no more than body weight. So at the moment I'm doing 60 kilos, and I'll alternate legs and then another exercise. So I'll do, let's say, 5x5 on the squat rack with 60 kilos, but between sets on the squat rack, I'll do some band work on rotator cuff, or I'll do some press ups or some pull ups or something in between. So you're getting almost an aerobic, or, you know, you're keeping that heart rate just slightly elevated the whole time. So you're getting some sort of benefit there, while also allowing for recovery between sets on your legs and things. And that generally lasts an hour, and then I'll finish off with, you know, a bit of core workout stuff just for 5 minutes, and that'll generally take me up to just over an hour.
Okay. So race weight at the moment, 60 kg.
No. So no more than body weight. Unfortunately, coming off the off season, I reckon I'm about 68 at the moment. Okay. And I generally would like to be at around 64 kgs. Okay. When I race, I think that's a good balance for me between being powerful and healthy, but sure. Also I don't generally stay at 64 kilos for very long. I can stay there for a month or two, and generally I'll sort of be at 66 for most of the season.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a pretty decent drop down from the 70 kilos when you were running along Hadrian's Wall.
Yeah, well, I was at 75 kilos, I think. Okay. Back at my heaviest in the army.
Okay.
You know, just like thighs this big, and your neck was so big as well. Like I had a 16-inch collar shirt or something, because you've always got a helmet on with a night sight. So you've got like a 3-kilo weight on your head,
yeah.
Which you're on, it's on there for like 2 weeks at a time. So you'd finish an exercise and your neck would be absolutely hench. Yeah.
That's a great tip. For anyone who's looking to build up their neck muscles, get an army issue helmet and a night sight, and you'll triple your neck in size.
Yeah, good for boxers. Yeah.
Exactly. That's a really useful breakdown of what's going on there, which I think leads quite nicely into diet. You're doing a hell of a lot of exercise. So this last week, for example, has been... And well, you've got a race next weekend, serious race. So you're not kind of full steam ahead this week. And even so, well, yeah. Even so, so since Monday, you've clocked up just short of 170K. You've done 5,700 meters of elevation. Last week, you were just short of 300K, 9,000 meters in elevation. You know,
I see. That must be my run and bike combined, right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
That's it. Based on the fact that as guys, we need 2,500 calories per day. So your active calorie count alone last week was 11,000 calories. So total calories, you're talking 23,500 calories, which if we're talking about tacos, that's just under 100 tacos, my preferred supplement of choice.
Nice.
How are you getting all of this in? Because, you know, Otherwise, you'll just start fading away.
This is one of my favorite subjects. so last week, the whole distance thing can be misleading because they don't know how many Ks of that was running or biking. So last week, I think it was about 25 hours, which for me is about a normal sort of training camp week worth of hours. Back in summer last year, I was doing sort of 32-hour weeks. And then when you're at that, I find the 30-hour mark is a sort of critical point where you are not eating according to hunger. You're just eating the whole time. You eat before a session, you eat during a session, you eat after a session, and you're genuinely not actually hungry. You're not waiting for hunger to hit. You just have to keep on shoving food in. And on those days, those weeks, you're probably looking at over 5,000 calories a day. At the moment, 25 hours a week is my sort of happy spot because I can eat fairly normally. You just eat a big breakfast, a big lunch with, you know, two courses, and probably again, you know, two courses at supper with a bit of, you know, fueling during the session as well. But you're not really shoveling the calories and food down. Definitely for those 30-hour weeks as well, I will tend to eat very wholesome. So I won't sort of reduce any food groups, eating whole foods, mostly plant-based, but plenty of meat, bit of dairy, lots of eggs. And plenty of like croissants, donuts, anything when I'm stopping on the bike. If I'm out on a long run, I'll get a three-course lunch at a, you know, local Spanish restaurant. So it's a big part of the training. And it's something in the past, definitely when I started, I was just so ignorant. I just didn't understand, you know, that you can't just eat 2,500 calories a day as you would normally and expect to be able to train 4 or 5 hours a day. And it's probably why I wasn't getting, you know, the gains just weren't coming at all in terms of fitness early on, because I just wasn't eating enough. And something I changed last year and really, really I noticed improve my performance was, you know, actually you can, if you starve your body, it's not going to give you any adaptation. If you overfeed your body, you're going to get really good adaptation because the body has got, you know, almost a surplus. And in the same way, if you reduce your calories, all your body does is sort of brings your metabolism down. You get cold, you get tired, and you get injured. So I really try and focus on actually try and give the body as much as it can take so that you can almost, I'm not saying I'm raising my metabolism, but I'm giving the body everything it needs for repair and performance.
Mm-hmm. Are there any go-to snacks, any guilty pleasures that get you to that calorie mark?
I mean, I bake a lot. So on a 30-hour week, so what have I baked? Lots of bread, baked a sweet potato pie this week. I'll often make croissants. It's just when you're on those high-hour training weeks, actually the calories don't matter so much as to where they're coming from. Okay. You know, you've just got to get that energy in. It might not look so good when you do performance testing because you're probably burning a lot of carbohydrates and less fat. But if you're consistently doing 30-hour training weeks, I can guarantee like you're going to build up a huge engine and you're going to become very, very fit almost regardless of what you eat. But then on a sort of an easier training week, then I'll sort of dial back on the donuts and croissants and things, and probably actually even dial back as well on the meat consumption. So I'll only eat meat once a week at the moment, once or twice a week. I'll keep in a bit of dairy and a bit of eggs, so I'm not completely cutting out a food group. But I find if I do that for 4 or 5 weeks before a race, and we're lucky here, we have lots of delicious fresh fruit and vegetables from the market. You know, you definitely do notice I'll lose half a kilo a week on that sort of protocol, lean up, but still maintain muscle. And generally you just feel, you know, you feel like you are a bit lighter and healthier and that you haven't got so many croissants going around the system, which I think is when you want to peak and really get that sort of last extra bit of performance out of you for a race, it does make a difference.
For sure. It's very interesting, your take on meat, which I think, especially depending on what sort of sports you're involved in, there'll be quite a heavy focus, or you go the other way and people really back off it. Obviously, it does produce naturally a certain amount of inflammation. How has your kind of relationship with meat changed? Have you always been pretty limited on the meat front, and how have you, or why have you chosen to eat it about once a week?
Not at all. Over the years, had very normal diet. I have experimented though with veganism. Went completely vegan for 6 months. Dropped down to like 62 kilos. And incidentally, that's exactly when my ankle injury happened. I was suddenly really, really skinny, didn't look that healthy. And then next thing you know, something goes pop. So I think it could be coincidence, but I also think it's quite interesting that that's when I got my worst injury. Nothing, it's not that I don't think eating less meat is better. It's just for most of the time, you know, I'll have it 3-4 times a week. And then just as I get close to competition, me personally, I find by reducing generally the amount of animal products, getting close to competition, that my cardiovascular system seems to be just a bit more efficient and I get a little bit leaner just before a race. It's a bit of a dark art, because like when I went vegan, you feel amazing to start with. And you get really lean, you look really ripped, and you think, great, I'm never going back. But some people, it's sustainable. And again, it's that whole sort of, everyone is an expert at nutrition because everyone has a diet that works for them. So I think it's just something that people should play with, but just be conscious that you can't lose half a kilo a week and do that every week, you know, because eventually something's going to give.
Absolutely. No, if you're taking something out, you've got to be putting something back in. Otherwise, as you say, things will start to go wrong. And then coming back to what you said with regards to running off carbs, running off fats, when we're looking at this under race situations, how are you fueling these, you know, some multi-day events? What's the nutrition like, and how does it change there?
The shorter the race, the more carb-centered. So for example, like Ironman or up to 100-kilometer ultra race, again, you're looking at a similar time period between 9 and 12 hours. You can pretty much, I find, get away with mostly gels, chews, bars, that kind of thing. So very high carb, high sort of sugar, mostly in a sort of easily digestible form, liquids and in drink form, and obviously the gels. But I reckon around that sort of 9-10 hour mark, your stomach and your whole system just gets a bit sick of it. And then that's when I'll start practicing with more whole foods. Like I said, on a long run, I'll stop for a full lunch. When you get going again, you know you've got food in your stomach, but it's a great way of training the gut to, you know, digest a 3-course meal while you're running back down a mountain. And I find that, particularly for the sort of, as you get towards that 100K distance up to the 100-mile distance, is so essential, because you really cannot survive 24 hours on gels and chews alone. Maybe you can. Personally, I can't. And also just to get more calories and more food in, give, you know, get some salt in there, get something that your stomach can actually hold on to a bit. It's good to practice with sort of the more whole foods, fats, protein and things.
Absolutely. I mean, you know all about it when you've got a 3-course meal in you running back down the mountain. That's certainly one way of doing it. Who was it? I think it was coming back to Joe Skipper. There was he was saying, go and get a fish and chips in you halfway through your race. If you can handle that, you're going to have a gut of
steel. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's an interesting strategy. I think for me, it definitely works. Whole foods are better. I'm not a huge fan of gels, but
so on even on like the Ironman bike and things, you will be, what will you be eating?
I'm quite experimental with my nutrition.
You're that guy with like the massive like footlong on the bike.
Yeah, do you hear about strapped it? To my bike.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've seen it. I've seen that.
Unbelievable. So what actually really worked for me on the last full distance that I did, my coach at the time was also very big on, you know, go for whole foods. And then when we hit the run, okay, you just do it on gels and take, you know, as many gels you need to get the mission done. For me, oats were just made me feel really good. And so you got these like Clif bars, which are like £3 a pop. And so I decided to make my own. And it was a bit of a mix of oats. There's some cacao in there, the majority of a pot of honey. And you just chuck them in, stick them in the microwave, let them cool, wrap them up in paper, and they were just shoved down the back of my dry suit, which certainly when they start heating up, you've got to get them in. It's a bit of a messy business, but worked for me really well.
I used to do the same thing with homemade chocolate brownies. Again, yeah. Really messy business if it gets hot, but it's just, you know, if it works, it works, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's going to get hot. You're pushing some watts and you heat up. It's pretty unavoidable. Looking forwards and what you've got on the horizon now, next kind of races that you're gearing up to. So we got one this next weekend and kind of your objectives for the season ahead. What does that look like for you?
So next weekend is Trans Gran Canaria. I'm doing the advanced 84K distance. And the reason I signed up for that one is because it's the unofficial trial for the GB selection team for the long course trail team. So the 80K trail team. Fantastic. The world champs are in Austria in June. So there's a chance I could get selected there. I actually picked up COVID in Thailand before I ran 100 miles, and running the race there was a mistake. I've sort of basically gave myself, I think, long COVID as a result. So I'm sort of still coming back a bit from that. So I'm just happy that I feel okay to race next weekend. If I get, you know, close to the podium, that'll be a great result. So I'm not putting too much expectations on next weekend. Really the main focus for this year is UTMB. So I qualified by coming sixth in Thailand. I get direct access to UTMB this year. So everything is sort of building up towards that. I'll do another race in April, might do another race in June as well. The 100 mile TT champs is actually at home, 5 miles from home in Norfolk in July. So I found using the bike for Kona worked really well for the build up towards Thailand, for building up that sort of base fitness. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be quite a good event to do before UTMB. And then
this is a 100 mile bike TT.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, there'll be some serious pesty guys in full kit there. Absolutely. And then after UTMB, I have nothing planned except for a marathon in December. So that's a sort of fun project, because I've run a couple of marathons before, but never very, you know, not one on its own for the last 4 years, 5 years. So it'd be nice to see sort of what I can crank out on the marathon.
Absolutely. And all these events that you just gone through, are they all kind of single day events, or are they stretched over some?
All single day this year. Maybe later in November, I might try and fit in another Ultra X event, which would be nice. But again, like last year, I raced 9 times or like 9 events last year, some of them only 2 weeks apart, which was great in terms of like once you're on a roll, you don't want to stop and you keep winning. But then I think as well, by the end of the year or at certain points in the year, I definitely felt like I was probably pushing it a bit too far. So this year I've got 5 events I think, officially in the calendar. You know, if I add in one or two more, I'll probably be okay, but I don't want to get, you know, trapped into sort of burning out as an athlete. It's a really, sure. You've got to look at it as a long game. Could be doing this for 5 years, could be doing it for 10. So keep thinking along those sort of timelines and like what you're doing to your body. So I think at that sort of, if you want to be competitive for all those races, 5 is probably a good number for me. Mm-hmm. There are athletes. There was a guy in Thailand. He runs 100 miler every month. A guy called Sanjay Sherpa from Nepal. It's unbelievable. Look, if you want to look up some results, look at his. Okay. He just runs 100 miler after 100 miler. It's insane. It works for some people. Some people only do, you know, 2 or 3 events a year, just like an elite marathoner would.
Yeah.
So it really depends.
Yeah, it's interesting though that you mentioned between sort of, you know, we'll see how we are in maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years. In general, and this is something we haven't quite covered, but it's interesting, these kind of ultra events, it's certainly changing. I mean, you with yourself is a perfect example of how being really competitive, younger ranks coming through, but it's kind of traditionally been slightly more of an older age group who've been really competitive when it comes to kind of these ultra races. So from, you know, career progression, if you compare it to someone, say, I don't know, professional footballers, by the time you're mid-20s coming to 30s, you're kind of on the way out, whereas you know, you're still got plenty of time ahead. Is this something that you see yourself continue to be kind of involved in say 20 years time? How do you see things on the kind of on the horizon?
Yeah, once I've won UTMB 3 times, you know, got a few titles under the belt, you know, the clients will be, they'll come flooding in.
That's it.
And you know, I'd like to stay. I think it's such a great sport and community of people who are involved in it. You know, I could see myself in the long term, whether it's coaching or camps or who knows. I suppose it really depends how many years I can keep going now, how high a level I can get to in terms of results will probably determine that. It could be in 5 years' time that I'm sick of running and I'll be like, you know what, you know, I had some good results, but again, you know, change is good. It's always good, you know, not to be doing the same thing for your entire life, I think. And who knows, I might go back to a more normal job and, you know, just run for fun in a few years' time. So we'll have to wait and see.
To see what happens.
Yeah.
And just for anyone who hasn't come across UTMB before, this is one of the kind of top ultramarathons. And the culmination is now in Mont Blanc. I think Ironman have just invested a significant chunk and now made a kind of big series out of it. And so previously it was just the Mont Blanc run, if I'm not mistaken. And now they've built
The UTMB World Series. It's going to be interesting this year because last year everyone was getting in on the old system. So if you were Kilian Jornet, you went, well, I'm Kilian Jornet, and they go, well, of course you come race it.
Yeah.
But now this year you've got the whole qualification process. So I qualified in Thailand, but as far as I know, Kilian hasn't qualified. Jim Wormsley hasn't qualified. Has Powell qualified yet? Tom Evans is going to be doing Western States. Matthew Blanchard, who came second, is going to be doing Western States. Again, I don't know if they get qualification from podium, but all these big names, they might not actually be there this year because of the new system. I know I'm sort of fingers crossed as a result. You know, I might have a much better chance this year in terms of how high up I'll finish as a result of the whole new qualification system and professionalization of the sport.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. We'll have to see how that goes. And finally, just coming back to your training camp, is this open for business? If people wanted to come out and spend some time with you, how do they go about doing that?
So the business itself is called Athelysium. Elysium being the sort of heaven where if you were favored by the gods, you would go to after, you know, death in battle or whatever. Ath, obviously short for athlete, is sort of athlete heaven, is sort of what I was going for Athelysium. There is a website. You can book onto camps, or I am doing a bit of work on the website at the moment. So I am starting to do coaching. Camps are available. You can find us on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram. So just get in touch via any of those means.
Excellent. Before we close off, two final questions. So if you had to go back and do this all again, knowing now what you know, what you've been through, fair amount of pain and suffering across the board, and I imagine, you know, a significant learning curve, how would you go about kind of doing things differently? How would you save yourself a huge amount of time to kind of get where you are today? What were the kind of the main points there?
I think the main point is I don't think I fully understood the training requirements in terms of hours that you need to put in year after year until probably a few years ago. And that's where I suddenly was like, all right, I need to get up to that sort of 1,000 hours of training a year mark. Sort of hand in hand with that, I think I sort of mentioned earlier, either consulting an expert in the sport or getting a coach early on, not necessarily to do your training, but just because they can literally educate you. If you say to them, I want to win Kona, I want to win UTMB, they're going to go, well, you need to do 1,200 hours a year, probably minimum for the next 15 years if you want to do that. And then you can go, okay, I'm doing 300 hours a year, let's say, at the moment. And then you suddenly go, wow, four times as much training in a year. And that'll really put it into context if you're sort of starting out, if you are serious. If you just, you know, if you're like, actually, I just want to do well at my local park run, then you can probably go, you know what, I'm just going to stick to my 300 hours a year and enjoy the sport. I don't want to do four times as much training. I think that would probably be the key piece of advice if you're starting out.
So volume and also consistency. Yeah.
I suppose that is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to make it to the top, you know, the 10,000 hour rule is a pretty good, you know, benchmark, gives you a good idea of how many hours you need to put in. And when you see people at the top of the sport now, whether it's the Norwegians in triathlon or it's Killian in trail running or whoever, you know, they've been putting in over 1,000 hours of work. I think the Norwegians are doing about 1,400 hours a year generally at the moment, but they've been doing that at a professional level for the last 10 years. So that gives you the sort of an idea of how much work is required.
I mean, yeah, those guys were, I mean, it's completely ridiculous where they're kind of pushing the sport, and certainly just in terms of pure volume, you know, Christian.
Norway in general. I mean, if you look at their medal haul compared to their population size at the Olympics, it's just insane.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Got to find out what's in the water in Bergen. Have to start importing and bottling it up. Tom, this has been really good. I've really enjoyed this. I got a huge amount of value. Thank you so much for coming on. Before we leave each other and say goodbye, is there anyone that you can think of, or any particular type of athlete that you think could be really interesting to get on the podcast, who's got some an interesting story, some value to share?
So I think you've actually tried to get him on the podcast already. So I was thinking about this and I was like, George Kirkpatrick, because we've sort of had this sort of shared ambition of trying to make it as an elite athlete. He was an incredible cyclist and still is a good athlete. But like 2 years ago, I think he did 27,000 kilometers of cycling in 1 year while maintaining a full-time job. And he's a type 1 diabetic, which, you know, isn't a factor for him. He just deals with it. He gets on with it. And if there's someone who, like, you know, has put himself through an incredibly tough amount of training in such a short time, he would come out here for cycling for like 2 weeks at a time. I'd be hanging on for dear life to his back wheel, being like, oh my God, who is, what is this? He's a monster on the bike back in the day. And yeah, I think really interesting story. I think particularly with that as his sort of background. So that would be my nomination. I think we need to bully him. I'm going to bully him now and try and get him on.
I didn't realize you knew George so well. I came across him on a friend's stag do, and very humble chap.
Yeah.
It was later talking to the groom to be, that I got wind of his story, and I was absolutely blown away.
This wouldn't happen to be Tom Orchard stag do, was it?
Guilty as charged.
It was. Nice.
Yeah. His feats on the triathlon front, but then also like the Red Bull time lapse.
Yeah, insane. He won it 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row. Yeah. And I think he clocked, so the first one was outdoors.
Yeah.
And then the second one, you know, kind of deep COVID, I think it was, on the turbo. The guy put in like 900K on the turbo.
Yeah, over 900K in 25 hours. Yeah.
And he's diabetic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an unbelievable story. He's a very busy man. I've dropped him a few messages, so
I'll give him a few more nudges. I'll give him a few more nudges.
George, I think it'd be great to have him on. If you're listening, we're coming for you.
Good stuff.
And on that note, thank you very much, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's been really fun.
And best of luck with your race next weekend. We're looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
So good to hear from Tom and his incredible journey in sport. Absolutely buzzing to get the shoes on and go and explore some trails. Please let us know any other physical specimens you'd like to hear from. You can drop us a message on our Instagram or on any of our social platforms. Finally, if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate your support. Drop us a review and a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It helps a huge amount. Until next time.